Nuclear film fallout. When a big new Hollywood film about the very real threats of nuclear weapons hits not only movie screens, but a major streaming platform, you know there's going to be fallout all across the industry as activists seek to further expose and build upon shocking revelations and nukesters attempt to discredit the film and cover up what it's saying. But it's an opportunity for a lot of truth to come out, including even some issues, staffing issues, that the industry would rather we not know about. So when an expert who has spent decades bird-dogging the nuclear industry from an organizational base in New Mexico, and he unexpectedly reveals...
There's an issue just below the surface, and that is that 800 or 900 people per year quit the lab. Those people have to be replaced each year and trained. These are not mostly retirements of older Cold War workers. That wave has come and gone. These are primarily new workers who have been recruited by glossy advertising and great promises, which is quite a lot. But the reality of work at this laboratory and in New Mexico does not meet the expectations of hundreds of people every year.
So not only are they focused on creating the plutonium pits, which will allow new nuclear weapons to be built, they can't retain the personnel to build them. Well, when the nuclear industry's new recruits are fleeing good-paying jobs within the industry they trained for, and Los Alamos National Lab can't even keep staff on board to perpetuate their work, upon which the entire nuclear defense system depends, you get an unexpected bonus set of insights into that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we take a look at the stir that is just starting to be stirred in the wake of the release of the film A House of Dynamite, directed by Oscar winner Kathryn Bigelow. As the film portrays a possible scenario that follows the launch of a nuclear weapon at the United States, we explore what kinds of response the activist community is coming up with to take advantage of this opening in the country's nuclear consciousness. We talk with Greg Mello, executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, a group which seeks nuclear disarmament, environmental protection and enhancement, social justice, and economic sustainability. LASG, as it's known, located in the belly of the beast in Albuquerque, has already held events and is planning more around the film. And it presents a template for other groups to follow, just as response to the film is revving up. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest information than most audience members viewing A House of Dynamite walked into that theater ready to learn. But we'll work with them. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 28th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out in Ukraine, where to round out a story that we have been covering for a month now, The Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant has had its external power supply restored after a month having to rely on emergency diesel generators to power its essential safety functions. International Atomic Energy Agency Director Rafael Mariano Grossi called the repair of the power line, which has been down since September 23rd, a, quote, crucial step for nuclear safety and security. The repair work began on Saturday, October 25th, after what Grossi said had been weeks of complex negotiations, leading to Russia and Ukraine agreeing to an IAEA proposal to establish temporary ceasefire zones around two specific locations on opposite sides of the front line to enable their respective expert teams to conduct repairs on two power lines that were recently damaged during the military conflict. For contrast, know that before the war, there were 10 different external power lines to the plant. Since the Russian military took control of the six-unit Zaporizhzhia nuclear power facility, this is the 10th time that the plant has lost external power, although on all previous occasions it was for a matter of hours rather than for the current case of a full month. Without external power supply, it relies on a fleet of emergency diesel generators to provide essential safety functions, including powering cooling pumps. But the emergency diesel generators are only expected to operate for 7 to 10 days before running out of fuel, and they are also not made to run for long periods of time. So the immediate bullet at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station has been ducked, but there's no word of when the next one will happen or how close it will be whizzing by. Here in the U.S., as of October 20th, the National Nuclear Security Agency, or NNSA, furloughed more than three-quarters of its staff as the government neared its fourth week of a shutdown, which as of this recording is in its fifth week. This move leaves fewer than 400 working at the agency, which is in charge of overseeing the nation's nuclear stockpile. What could go wrong? These 400 NNSA federal employees continued to work to support the protection of property and the safety of human life as best they could. However, the NNSA's Office of Secure Transportation was only funded for an additional week, which expired on Monday, October 27. This is the first time in NNSA's 25-year history that it has furloughed employees during a shutdown. The longer the shutdown lasts, the more damaging and dire the consequences will be for workforce retention and weapons modernization efforts critical to national security. But that didn't stop the Energy Department's National Nuclear Security Administration, NNSA, from announcing that it is using artificial intelligence as part of an extensive modernization program for nuclear warheads. Again, we ask, what could go wrong? David Beck, who has more than 40 years' experience working with nuclear weapons and is the nominee for the post of NNSA Deputy Administrator for Defense Programs, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that warhead and other modernization are a priority. We must act with urgency and precision. Our mission cannot fail. Therefore, we must lead with discipline, innovation, and unwavering focus on results, which sounds to Nuclear Hot Seat like a perfect environment for mistakes, big with major consequences mistakes to be made. Beck also revealed that current modernization efforts are for 7 warheads, which include missile and bomber warheads, and the development of low-yield submarine-launched nuclear cruise missiles. Mr. Beck vowed that, if confirmed, a top priority will be to ensure NNSA facilities deliver critical programs on time and on budget, which is nuke speak for faster and cheaper. Two words you never want to hear in connection with anything nuclear. In a story that almost qualifies as numbnuts, except it's so frightening, Trump is preparing a dangerous giveaway to struggling commercial nuclear startups. To quote from a story written by Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear and Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story fame, So-called new reactor designs need a special kind of fuel, and that fuel requires a particular ingredient, plutonium. Plutonium is the trigger component of a nuclear bomb, and you can't make one without it. Now imagine that a former board member of one of those struggling startup companies, Oklo, is Chris Wright, the current U.S. Secretary of Energy in the Trump government. Lo and behold, all of a sudden, Trump is offering Oklo plutonium for free from a stockpile of close to 20 metric tons or more. The White House has announced that it will begin revealing its lucky free plutonium recipients on December 31st, based on applications received by the U.S. Department of Energy by November 21st. This according to Reuters. But with former Oklo board member Chris Wright, now U.S. Energy Secretary, in charge of handing out free plutonium to his former company, might it be appropriate to raise questions about conflict of interest? And why would any company need that much plutonium, which is enough for at least 2,000 nuclear bombs? This is all wrong-headed. But again, too horrifying a thought to be assigned the label numbnuts. But that brings to mind...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
The DC Summer Nuclear Project in South Carolina was never finished after utilities spent $9 billion with a B dollars and raised rates for customers. It was abandoned in 2017 amid construction delays and cost overruns. But now, hey, there's such a push for AI to have all the energy that can possibly be produced. Southern California officials are now looking to complete the project, which is located just north of Columbia. So where do they turn? To the same office where the massive nuclear project was abandoned 8 years ago. Brookfield Asset Management was selected to finish two VC Summer nuclear reactors as of last week. And Jimmy Statton, CEO of Santee Cooper, which is South Carolina's state-owned electricity and water utility, actually said that completing the VC Summer nuclear reactors won't cost taxpayers anything while generating a maximum of 2,200 megawatts, adding, "There are no additional financial risks for our customers at all." To which Nuclear Hot Seat adds, if you believe that, he also has some really good coastal land in Fukushima that he'd like to sell you. In case you don't recall, Santee Cooper was in charge of the VC Summer expansion effort from 8 years ago and walked away from it. At the time, the expansion effort was considered the greatest construction failure in the state's history. Taxpayers spent some $9 billion on the effort, seeing higher power bills to pay for a project that was never built. And Dominion Energy customers are still paying about 5% of their monthly bills for the original expansion project. The original project was such a mess that some utility executives were charged criminally and sent to prison for failing to let shareholders, lawmakers, and the public know about problems that had begun to develop during construction. And now it's deja vu all over again, as the same cast of characters is picking up the same project and expecting us to believe that there will be different results and it won't cost anyone anything. They say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, which makes the boneheads behind this latest iteration for VC Summer eligible for extensive mental exams, which they will undoubtedly fail. And that's why, this week, Santee Cooper, CEO Jimmy Statton, and all the other Nimrods who think this is a good idea, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat Numbnuts of the Week.
Although the Navajo Nation has reached an agreement with Energy Fuels Incorporated on uranium transportation through tribal land, many tribal members remain concerned that it won't protect them from the harms of uranium contamination. Tribal leaders say they had little choice but to enter into the agreement, as federal law preempts any tribal regulations that conflict with it regarding the transportation of radioactive materials. Now, that's what we call a loophole. The trucks carrying the uranium passed in between the four sacred mountains of the Navajo Nation, through land coming from the Pinyon Plain Mine in Arizona's Kaibab National Forest, which sits just outside the western boundary of the Navajo Nation, to the White Mesa Mill in southern Utah. The vehicles traveled more than 260 miles on roads known for compromised safety standards and a large number of accidents. There's much more in this story, and we will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 748. And a little bit of good news. A one-year project to deepen the Associated Press's reporting on nuclear security and to improve journalism on nuclear security field-wide through skills training with other news outlets, the AP has teamed with the Outrider Foundation to announce a major nuclear security reporting initiative in collaboration with the Carnegie Corporation of New York. With journalists in nearly 100 countries, the Associated Press will leverage its global reporting network to provide expanded explanatory, visual, enterprise, and investigative coverage to inform the general public about nuclear security issues. Additionally, AP will develop ways to help newsrooms improve the general news industry's understanding of nuclear security issues. It will also provide member news organizations with video analyses from nuclear experts in academia as part of its Campus Insights program. More coverage and more clarity as we join together to narrate the rearrangement of the deck chairs on the nuclear Titanic. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, it's only 2 weeks until the start of the International Uranium Film Festival here in the United States. It starts in Window Rock on Navajo Nation in Arizona on November 13th to 14th, and then moves up to Las Vegas, November 21st to 23rd. As I have for the past three incarnations of the IUFF in Navajo Nation, I am intending to go and to bring you all of the excitement. The films being screened, interviews with filmmakers, talks with indigenous leaders on the front lines of protecting their lands from uranium mining, transport, and accidents. And when I say accidents, it's both the old sites, which have never been cleaned up, and the new ones, which will inevitably happen. The IUFF provides a platform for the powerful, ever-growing ingathering of activists and members of the local community to find each other and talk, and a place where we learn of ongoing difficulties and celebrate hard-fought wins. Traveling to cover nuclear events is an important part of my work with Nuclear Hot Seat. And the most important part for traveling is me getting there. And that requires the raising of funds so I'm able to do so. I want to thank the members of Nuclear Hot Seat who have already donated to help with transportation and travel costs to this year's IUFF, and I want to invite those of you who have not yet donated but feel the impulse to step forward now to close the funding gap. Know that funds raised are over and above the monthly costs of running Nuclear Hot Seat, and as we don't run ads or take sponsorships, the only possible source of these necessary funds is you. So help me get to Window Rock to cover the events for Nuclear Hot Seat. Please consider making a donation and know that we make it easy for you to do so. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. Again, nuclearhotseat.com, red donate button, or if you prefer, send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Anytime a new big-budget Hollywood film on nuclear issues premieres, A window of opportunity opens up for activist groups to get out honest information, with the chance that some new people will pay attention and come in to support our movement. Such is the case following the release of the film A House of Dynamite. Directed by Oscar winner Kathryn Bigelow, the film follows three separate tracks of response to the same event, a nuclear missile launch of unknown origin on the United States. This taut thriller follows the same 18 minutes from detection to the unshown inevitable conclusion, and it does so from three perspectives: the White House Situation Room, the United States Strategic Command, and finally, the President himself. The film provides a platform for discussion of nuclear deterrence as not being able to deter or deflect an attack, and leaves us to consider if there are earlier steps that could have been taken to step back from the nightmare edge of nuclear possibility. Kathryn Bigelow, who grew up during the Cold War and remembers those duck and cover exercises, said she wanted to remind audiences that, quote, our world is combustible, and that she's glad if people come away from the movie as concerned as she is. A House of Dynamite opened in movie theaters on October 10 and dropped on Netflix streaming on October 24th. It must be successful because it's already stirring up nuclear proponents to undercut it. The Pentagon in particular is unhappy with the film, which at one point has the defense secretaries claiming that current missile defenses have only a 50% chance of intercepting a missile despite their $50 billion with a B dollar price tag. In response, the Pentagon claimed that real-world testing, quote, tells a vastly different story from the events depicted, that the 50% claim is based on earlier prototypes, and that today's interceptors, quote, have displayed a 100% accuracy rate in testing for more than a decade, end quote. To which the movie's screenwriter, Noel Oppenheimer, said to The Atlantic, that's based on data from controlled tests. So, you can imagine, those are under the best of circumstances. As we mention in the movie, there are fewer than 50 of these ground-based intercepts in our arsenal. So even if it were working perfectly, there are not a ton of them that we have available to use. And a lot of the folks we talked to felt that 61% was being very generous when it comes to the system that we have. While it's true that the Pentagon was not consulted during the making of this movie, its credits reveal a long list of tech advisors who have worked in the Pentagon, at least some of whom were on set every day. And while the big media push now is on the director, the screenwriter, the Pentagon, and the like, Nuclear Hot Seat wanted to take a look at the grassroots and what this film might mean to activists on the ground who are fighting against nuclear proliferation and for peace. The first group to have jumped on the film as an organizing and consciousness-raising opportunity is the Los Alamos Study Group. Located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and focused on Los Alamos, the birthplace of the atomic bomb, since 1989, LASG, as it is known, has worked on nuclear and energy policy research, environmental analysis, congressional education and lobbying, community organizing, litigation, and advertising. Now it's stepping up to take advantage of A House of Dynamite and the awareness it is creating about nuclear threats and dangers. LASG is led by executive director and co-founder Greg Millo, and I spoke with him on Monday, October 27, 2025. Greg Millo, it's always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Libby.
Let's start out with some background information about the organization. What is the Los Alamos Study Group, and what is the focus of your work?
Well, we're a kind of think tank and action tank. We lobby, we litigate, we organize, we write, we try to be a clearinghouse for journalists on nuclear issues, specifically nuclear weapons issues. We've been doing this quite a while now, more than three decades.
While you are not specifically in Los Alamos, you are in what is arguably the belly of the beast, meaning that part of the world. Where are you located, and Considering that Los Alamos, where the first atomic bombs were built and tested for the Manhattan Project, what do you know about the town's continuing involvement with the nuclear industry?
Well, we're located in Albuquerque. We have the two largest laboratories on either side of us. Well, Sandia on one side, Los Alamos on the other. Los Alamos being the best funded nuclear weapons facility in the world. And down the street, we have Kirtland Air Force Base, where there are more nuclear weapons than anywhere else on the planet. So we're in a nuclear hot seat, as you might put it, right here.
I would assume that nuclear-related businesses are a major employer in the area. How hard has that made it through the years to continue as a group and to get your points across?
It has helped more than it has hurt. So, businesses, by that we mean government contractors primarily, the two largest being Los Alamos and Sandia, which dominate the federal spending in the state, actually. They spend a lot of money. It's probably more than 10 times as concentrated a level of nuclear warhead spending as in any other state. So the politics are really dominated in the state by nuclear weapons. That means you can't count on our political leaders to help. That's for sure. They're on the other side. Yeah, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they do everything they can to bring in the nuclear dollars. So we work around them.
And the media in your area, the newspapers, any broadcast outlets there might be, meaning traditional old style media, are they on your side? Are they impartial? Do they lean towards favoring pro-nuclear positions?
Well, they do increasingly favor nuclear positions because of the money and jobs, but they are capable of being outraged. And we have quite a lot of impacts from these industries in the state, which do make good news. It's not traditionally what you call nuclear news. Los Alamos has grown so much in the last 5 or so years that it has really put an enormous strain on the regional housing market, the road network, the labor markets. Everything is negatively impacted by the push to make new nuclear weapons pits or the cores, triggers, the Rocky Flats mission at Los Alamos. It's a new mission, it's gigantic, and the infrastructure of the region and its economic geography, its human geography, is not set up for that.
Let's move ahead because we are right now having a moment, courtesy a movie, a Hollywood movie, The House of Dynamite by Kathryn Bigelow, is the director. Has it opened locally? And if so, what, if any, response or impact has there been so far? How long ago did it open?
It opened a little more than 2 weeks ago in one theater in New Mexico. I do not know how many people saw it. We saw it on the opening day, and there were four people there, three of them in our organization. Last night, we did the first of four planned screenings of our own, which we followed with a discussion, and we'll do the same on the other three so that people will have a chance to look at this with others and parse some of what they've seen and see how it might apply and how they might be part of efforts to defuse the House of Dynamite.
Did you know about the film before it opened and what it addressed?
Yes, we knew it was widely reviewed starting when it opened in Venice.
So, having that little bit of advance notice on it, what, if any, plans and preparations did the Los Alamos Study Group make to take advantage of this media moment?
Well, we certainly let our closest volunteers, as well as a larger mailing list, know about it. We tried to get people to go to the commercial showings because of the excellent big screen, big sound, and we want them to come to our showings as well for the big discussion. And so, we did a fair bit of planning, and also we advertised. We put a double-page advertisement in this past Wednesday's weekly paper in Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Reporter. It's a free weekly. It's out for a week. And we put a large advertisement that went for some of the local issues and as they relate to the movie. It's hard to do it all in one ad. So someone called it an infomercial. That's what we did.
I would look at it as an advertorial because it was extremely detailed. The talking points in particular that you pulled out were important, but I thought it was remarkable to have that much information. Just so that people know, the title on it was Greed, Not National Security, Drives LANLs, that stands for Los Alamos National Lab, LANLs, Failing Plutonium Bomb Factory. And it has the subtitle, LANL's Unnecessary Ultra Expensive Factory is Years Behind Schedule, Costs Are Six Times What Was Promised, Production Still MIA, thankfully. Somebody reads that, they don't even have to read the article.
Yes, I'm glad that's what you got out of it. You could just read the headline and you get most of it. We have here this different situation than most people do because of the proximity we have to this facility and the ability to say no in a more powerful way because of that proximity. Pretty much everybody knows people who work at the labs, people who may or may not love what they do. It may feel trapped. We know the local political people. Like many medium-sized towns, the political elites are accessible to the public. And it's not quite as accessible as it used to be when you could regularly talk to your senators on the weekends at farmers market, but nonetheless, they're still relatively accessible. It's not like California. So it's important for people to have these details because it empowers them.
Has there been any kind of pushback against the film in Los Alamos? It's still early days, admittedly, but has anything come up where people are going, well, you can't say that, and that's wrong, and this is just Hollywood, and blah, blah, blah?
It is, like you said, early days, but I don't expect that. And in fact, a local digital newspaper took our press release in its entirety and put it on the top of their homepage for Wednesday night's screening in Los Alamos. So we were very grateful for that. It's excellent advertising for us. And so most people in Los Alamos will read the Los Alamos Daily Post.
Any pushback yet from the Chamber of Commerce, which is so keen to protect its jobs?
No, they're busy deciding what their gross receipts tax should be. And there's quite a debate about that. It's a course, and there is an interesting wrinkle in state law that manufacturing is not taxed. Well, manufacturing pits. And so they're afraid that part of Los Alamos's spending will be tax-free and they won't be able to draw a gross receipts tax from making nuclear weapons.
I'm making all kinds of faces over here because it's kind of like, yes, we're very concerned about nukes. We might not be able to tax them.
Yes, that's exactly right. So that's the debate going on. And tomorrow night, they're going to discuss this county council meeting. And this is what is being debated on the pages of the local blogs.
Not whether it's right or wrong, not whether they should proceed with it, not if maybe there are alternative pathways to take, nothing about the morality, nothing about the importance of where our money goes, but really how much money of the money that's there can we get is the nature of the debate.
Correct. But there's an issue just below the surface that will interest your listeners. And that is that 800 or 900 people per year quit the lab. And this is close to a crisis in that those people have to be replaced each year and trained. These are not mostly retirements of older Cold War workers. That wave has come and gone. These are primarily new workers who have been recruited by glossy advertising and great promises of everything that they promise, which is quite a lot. But the reality of work at this laboratory and in New Mexico does not meet the expectations of hundreds of people every year. Whether the morality is involved, yes, it is involved to some degree, a degree we don't fully understand. Quality of life issues are involved because Los Alamos Laboratory has so poisoned the environment, the social environment I'm talking about, the economic environment, that New Mexico is now the worst state in which to raise a child. It has the worst educational system in the country. It is difficult to find a doctor because physicians are leaving. Among the 50 states, it's kind of a basket case. And people who may come from a more functional situation can be shocked when they arrive. And so, underlying the issues about traffic congestion, which is severe, the labor market, the unaffordable housing, this problem of employee retention. And this, as it turns out, is most severe at Los Alamos, but it also is an issue across the nuclear weapons industry. It is an enormous point of vulnerability for peace activists. It is time that we started to have more dialogue with the people who are just like us, who are working in the fields of the bomb. And the movie does provide a way to begin talking about this and a way to begin talking about it also with young people. We think it's fabulously educational.
In the advertorial or opinion piece or advertisement, whatever you want to call it, that Los Alamos Study Group took out, you said that the National Nuclear Security Agency's poorly conceived pit experiment at LANL is fragile. That's not a word, fragile, that I would expect to ever see in conjunction with anything nuclear. What did you mean by that?
I meant that their previous plans have failed, and this one appears to be failing as well. They're fighting against factual circumstances that make it difficult to succeed. The manager of this program at Los Alamos once likened it, not so long ago, a couple of years ago, to overhauling an airplane while in flight with passengers aboard. That's fragile. It's a difficult thing to retool an active plutonium facility while there are people working in it on about six different programs which can't be halted. So the way they're doing this is at the end of the day shift, they erect temporary barriers, they're scaffolding if they need it. The way they're trying to do this is to work 24/7 and do their construction and equipment installation in the middle of the night, which entails a lot of setup and a lot of cleaning up. That's dangerous. Some of the workers, most of the workers, don't have the right kind of security clearance, so they need to be accompanied by armed guards. So the whole process is very slow and painful, and it's taking years. It will take 6 years minimum beyond what they said it would take. And it's, like I said, it's going to cost about six times as much, assuming they are successful at all. The military as a whole, the nuclear weapons complex, the contractors project an image of confidence across the board. But the technical problems, the managerial problems, institutional problems, human problems are always worse than are represented when the contract is given. And at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the culture is such that the problems are really underestimated.
Is there any kind of a forum or a format or a hotline for workers at Los Alamos to be able to say, we have a problem here. I'm concerned about something, where it's information that you might have access to and be able to then turn around and do something with.
If they are tough-minded, they may call us or they may call a reporter. The New York Times has put up little notices around town asking for whistleblowers to come forward because there are these situations. And to avoid this, the primary contractor is going slow and they're trying to be safe. It's partly because they actually do care about the workers, but they also care about bad publicity.
So you have already had your first evening where the film was shown and there was a discussion afterwards. That was Sunday, October 26th. Interestingly, at the Santa Fe Friends meeting, which is the Quakers, I'm very fond of the Quakers these days because of the Westheimer Peace Symposium and the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College. Did people show up for the screening and did they stick around for the discussion afterwards, or were they so overwhelmed they just fled with their hands over their ears to go to the nearest bar?
Yes, there was a discussion afterwards. I need to say that the Los Alamos Study Group, in its initial incarnation, was a project of the Santa Fe Friends Meeting. That is, some members of Friends Meeting were among our initial group, and we put our bank account there. And so our natality was within them. But, that was a long time ago. So they co-hosted this. And they have a beautiful setup there for viewing the film. So technically, it was very smooth and comfortable. About a third of the people left after the film, and two-thirds stayed. We had a good discussion. These days, our society is very atomized. So there were almost everyone is in left field.
What do you mean by they're in left field?
There's no strong unifying culture that draws people together. And so it is important for us to get together and talk and listen to different perspectives. And they were very different. If you go online, you will see very different perspectives about the movie. And some of that we had as well. Pretty much everybody was some stripe of political left, anti-nuclear. So we unfortunately did not have people on the political right, but that was Santa Fe. I expect on Wednesday in Los Alamos, we certainly will.
Moving forward, what do you hope the impact of the film is going to be, House of Dynamite, on the general public? And how are you hoping for this film to change things?
I think it's entirely up to we in our separate various organizations, whether they are religious or anti-nuclear or interested in political reform more broadly, because of the film by itself is not going to have any lasting impact. It's we who will create the lasting impact by what we do with the film. We hope that some of our more active people will help us use this in an educational setting, will amplify what we're able to do from our tiny office. But barring that, it's going to slip between the waves because we have an ongoing tsunami of crises in this country, right?
Have you been in conversation with any other activists or activist groups who have seen what you're doing and going, yowza, we need to get on this, or here's what we are doing, have you thought of this? Has there been any kind of brainstorming between the groups?
There were a couple of activist groups there, maybe three, four last night. Some stayed for the discussion, so we had some indication of what they were going to do, but it's early days.
Well, as you and the others come up with further plans for what to do with this film, because the fact that it just dropped on Netflix and it is already one of the top 10 showing up there shows that there's a tremendous amount of interest. How we harness that interest is what is going to determine whether we make an appreciable difference in at least the conversation around nukes, if not actively turn things around and start moving in the opposite direction to not make the pits, to not put the money there, which is going to be difficult to pull off. But if we all participate, if we all work in it and on it, there's a chance we might be able to make some differences. And I will take small differences because if we can't affect a large one, which it looks like we can't, let's just take the little teeny tiny ones one at a time and add them up.
Yes, I want to go back to the notion of fragility. I think aspects of the nuclear weapons enterprise are fragile, and that breakthroughs may be closer than we think. I've already said that Los Alamos pit production is fragile. The proposed new Sentinel ICBM is undergoing a similar redoing. I mean, it's super expensive and it's way harder than the proponents understood in the beginning. It may be more difficult than our society can do at this time when it's challenged economically, socially, and in other ways, politically. What I'm trying to say is there are other forces working at the same time that are more powerful than our small groups. We can be catalysts. We don't have to drive the train. There are other forces at work which are powerful, even more powerful than the military-industrial complex. Our economic situation is quite poor, and there are other countries in the world as well that have a, we don't run the world anymore. Let's put it that way. We don't have to generate the power through our movements to stop the military-industrial complex all by ourselves. We can be a catalyst. We just have to explain to the right people in the right way that it's not a good idea to pitch their tent on the railroad tracks. There's train, big trains are coming, and that will take different shapes. I think we should be confident, and I think we should be joyful in our work because we have our friends, we have each other, and this is a lot already. If we emphasize the quality of our experience as activists and as citizens, our work will sustain us as we work to make our society sustainable. So I'm really relatively confident. Even though at the same time, we do live in a house that's ready to blow. And the consciousness of that, it could be very motivating. And the realism of the movie, which we think it is quite realistic in the processes, in the plans, in the protocols, how it all might work, I don't think people understand how fragile the sanity is. How insane the plans are. Our decisions are hardwired and channeled into these suicidal directions. And it could be all too easy to go down one of those channels.
Or, as is said in the movie, it's surrender or suicide.
Right. Of interest, at a conference in the 90s, Robert McNamara said to those of us who were there that his private advice to Kennedy and Johnson was to never, under any circumstances, order the use of nuclear weapons. There should never be retaliation. Nuclear was never to be taken to the point of using nuclear weapons. This was a little bit of a revelation, and apparently he said that on other occasions as well. In the movie, one of the characters said, "Well, you know, we're not really in any danger unless we retaliate." Chicago, yes, Chicago was in danger, but symbolizing the country as a whole and the continuity of the United States, the real danger that this character was saying would be the result of our retaliation. And that is not the way the military thinks. at all. You know, you give an explosive to the military, call it a weapon, they have no other option but then to craft ways to win a nuclear war. That's what they do. They win wars. That's what they want.
But nobody can win a nuclear war.
Nobody can win. Nobody. And so it's really kind of a misnomer to call them nuclear weapons,
What would you prefer to call them?
nuclear suicide, nuclear omnicide devices, nuclear suicide devices. This is the reason why arms control, as it is conceived, is an oxymoron. You can't control this. You really have to thrust these nuclear weapons from you. Even such a hawk as Paul Nitze wrote in 1999, he saw no problem with unilateral nuclear disarmament. And I don't either.
So there are at least a couple of sane people.
Yeah, he came, he went a long way from being such a super hawk to making that statement toward the end of his life. We have a crisis right now in that we have a standoff, a nuclear standoff between the US and Russia. And I think one of the takeaways from the film is that the overall context of war and peace matters in a crisis. It's important that people have relationships, that there have been communications, that there are means, basis of trust. Right now, Trump has to decide whether to accept Putin's offer of retaining the quantitative limits of New START or let it lapse altogether. At the same time, Russia has just successfully tested a cruise missile powered by a nuclear reactor. This cruise missile has essentially unlimited range and endurance. It flew 14,000 kilometers on this test, going up and down and all around. It could be airborne for a month. So this is a qualitative new weapon, just as is the undersea intercontinental nuclear torpedo, which is now deployed. You know, we really are setting ourselves up for a terrible end.
And do all of these weapons require plutonium pits to explode?
They do. Yes, they all do.
So the place to start stopping this is not manufacturing more pits. We could start there.
Absolutely. And I want to say that if people want to come here and work with us, please do write us. And we will try to find a way to make that possible. Come visit because you can learn a lot here in the heart of the beast. It's an interesting place, to say the least.
Well, let's put it this way. I've never been bored talking with you. Greg Mello, you're doing a great job there. I want you to keep us in the loop as to any further developments. And for now, I want to wish you all the best with the screenings and with the talks afterwards and with stopping this madness. And of course, for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Lemie.
Greg Mello, the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. On our website, we will have a link up to that two-page advertorial that LASG published and that we spoke about during the interview. It's at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 748. We'll also have a link up to LASG so that you can contact Greg directly, as he has invited you to do. And I encourage you to check out their website. Lots of good information there, and they are constantly updating it.
Activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
Award-winning veteran environmental journalist Carol Grossman is being honored during a ceremony on November 15 in his hometown of Sag Harbor. Carol began his journalism career in the 1970s at the then Daily Long Island Press. And his nuclear reporting, which is known internationally, is considered to be responsible for 11 nuclear reactors not being built on Long Island. Bob DeLuca, president of the Group for the East End, a journalism group, put it best when he said, Carl Grossman's uncompromising dedication to public awareness about the critical and sometimes unscrupulous influences shaping our most consequential environmental decisions has made him an exceptional journalist and a passionate teacher. His work has produced real-world change, from nuclear power to protecting our bays and landscapes. Carl is an advocate's advocate, and we honor his exceptional work. To which Nuclear Hot Seat and I add, hear, hear, and absolutely. The event is scheduled for 1:30 to 4 p.m. on November 5th at the Sag Harbor Cinema, and we'll have a link up to where you can purchase tickets on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 748. And Kat Kramer's Films That Changed the World will present a special double feature honoring the legacy of filmmaker Stanley Kramer. And it will include both the still relevant and deeply moving On the Beach about nuclear war, and Judgment at Nuremberg, which examines post-World War II justice through the trial of German judges. The screenings commemorate both the 80th anniversary of the Nuremberg trials and the dropping of the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Between the two screenings, Kramer will moderate a think tank-style panel discussion with special guests to be announced. I'll give you a pre-announcement on one of them. That would be me. Kat Kramer established the series, Kat Kramer's Films That Changed the World, in 2009 to highlight socially conscious films and documentaries addressing urgent issues. This marks the first time Kramer has presented her father's films through the series. That's Sunday, November 23rd, here in Los Angeles at the Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills, beginning at 1:30, and we will have a link up to where you can purchase tickets on our website. Again, this episode is number 748. And a reminder that if you would like to support my upcoming trip to Navajo Nation to cover the International Uranium Film Festival, you can do so by going to NuclearHotSeat.com and clicking on the red donate button. Know that whatever you can do to help me get there is deeply appreciated, and you will be hearing all about it on a future episode of the show. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 28, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, or to help us out even more, cut to the chase and go to NuclearHotSeat.com. The yellow box pops up, you really can't miss it, and if you put in your first name and an email address, every week you will get one email, just one, we don't bug you, one email with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. You will get it as soon as it posts. And that's the best way to ensure that you never miss a single episode. You can help us out also if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview. Send that information to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount will help us out with our monthly costs, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as physicist Edward Teller, known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, once told reporters, there's no such thing as a foolproof system, because the fool is always greater than the proof. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.